The headlines. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro arrives in the Iranian capital, Tehran, for an official visit aimed at strengthening bilateral ties. Israel launches an airstrike on targets south of Damascus. Syria says it's intercepted most of the missiles. And Hezbollah warning Israel over its illegal gas drilling operation. The movement says it has enough power to stop Israel from plundering Lebanon's wealth. Hello and welcome, everybody. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has arrived in Iran at the head of a high-ranking political-economic delegation. Maduro is on a two-day visit at the invitation of Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi. The Venezuelan president will meet his Iranian counterpart and participate in a meeting of high-ranking officials from the two countries. Iran and Venezuela have both been targeted by U.S. sanctions, particularly in the energy sector. They've been closely cooperating to counter the effects of such economic pressure. In a phone call with his Venezuelan counterpart in December, Raisi said Venezuela is targeted by the U.S. because of its quest for independence and freedom. Raisi lauded Tehran-Caracas relations as strategic, underlining the need for the development of mutual ties, especially in trade and economy. Relations between Iran and the International Atomic Energy Agency have turned sour after the agency passed a resolution against Tehran this week. Iranians have reason to be outraged by the IAEA's accusation of lack of cooperation.
Since July 2015, when the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action came into existence, Iran's nuclear program has been open to inspections described as unprecedented in the history of the International Atomic Energy Agency. Under that agreement, Tehran voluntarily agreed to grant international inspectors easy access to its atomic sites well beyond its IAEA obligations. The agency was also allowed to install many more surveillance cameras at Iranian sites. The IAEA's inspections in Iran account for over a quarter of all agencies' monitoring activity around the world. Despite the close cooperation, the International Atomic Energy Agency is once again accusing Iran of failing to cooperate. This week, the IAEA's Board of Governors passed a resolution critical of Iran. The resolution was sponsored by the United States, Britain, France, and Germany. The agency says it is not satisfied with the answers Iran has provided to its probes of three sites. The resolution has been described as a blow to the stalled talks between Iran and the P4+1 group to revive the moribund 2015 deal. The IAEA resolution criticizing Iran was passed amid an intensified Israeli lobbying campaign to derail diplomacy with Iran. Israel is a sworn enemy of the hard-earned 2015 deal and makes no secret of its efforts to destroy it completely. The IAEA's Board of Governors passed its latest resolution just days after IAEA Director General Rafael Grossi visited Israel. Iran is also highly critical of the IAEA for failing to even raise the issue of Israel's nuclear weapons program during Grossi's recent visit. The atomic agency's credibility and impartiality are on the line as it seems to be yielding to pressure by nuclear-armed Israel to mount pressure on Iran.
But I do agree that Iran has good reason to be angry with the resolution, because it is an extension of the one rule for us and a different rule for you approach that's been taken by the IAEA with respect to Iran from the beginning of this entire issue. Iran has the right to develop nuclear technology. Iran has complied with inspections. And what appears to be the case here is that Israel and the United States are together attempting to restrict Iran's development as a nuclear power.
Well, Iran has been unrelenting in pursuing its rights in response to the IAEA's resolution. President Ebrahim Raisi says Iran will insist on its rights until they are fulfilled. Meanwhile, the Iranian nuclear chief has sharply criticized the International Atomic Energy Agency, warning that the IAEA is caught in the clutches of Zionists. The Israeli pressure seems to be aimed at making it impossible to restore the JCPOA.
After years of unprecedented inspections in its nuclear sites, the Iranian government seems to be outraged by the IAEA's censure. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi pledged that such measures will never force Iran to back down from its rights. Meanwhile, head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami, says it is unfortunate that the IAEA is being exploited by an illegitimate regime. He demanded the agency put a stop to infiltration by Iran's enemies in its operations. As tensions between Iran and the agency soared this week, Tehran informed the International Atomic Energy Agency that it is disconnecting over 24 surveillance cameras that were installed in Iran beyond the country's IAEA obligations. Iran is also installing 2 new cascades of the IR-6 advanced centrifuges at its Natanz atomic fuel production facility. The Iranian atomic chief has said that Iran provided accurate answers to IAEA questions, but the agency lacks the will to declare Iran's answers convincing. Iran argues that the IAEA's focus on the country is discriminatory because it accounts for only a small amount of global nuclear activity and is undergoing hundreds of inspections per year. Negotiators from Iran and the P4+1 have held a year of intense negotiations to try to find a way to restore the JCPOA, but talks have stalled since March. The latest episode between Iran and the IAEA could further complicate the negotiations. Observers believe that the IAEA is pushing things in the direction favored by Israel.
Well, I believe that the resolution, which is primarily aimed at disrupting Iran's nuclear development program, is just part of a broader program of regional hegemony on the part of Israel. This program of regional hegemony has been supported by the United States in the past, and in fact, Israel was a prime mover in having the United States invade Iraq on the false pretense of weapons of mass destruction. I'm deeply concerned, and I must say I'm far more concerned than the IAEA could be about Iran's nuclear development program. I am much more concerned than that about the potential for Israel developing this issue via its supporters in the United States and via its own Israel lobby in America to bring the entire region into a potential state of war.
Well, members of anti-Iran terrorist group MKO have attacked the reporter and accompanying news team of Press TV while reporting on an exhibition held in Stockholm on the group's crimes. Bianca Raimi tells us more in this report.
This is the moment an exhibition turned into a series of violent assaults committed by the MKO, a cult-like organization that has the blood of 17,000 Iranians on its hands. Press TV's camera crew, reporting on an exhibition showcasing MKO bombings and assassinations, was attacked by angry supporters of the group.
Don't touch my camera. Don't touch my camera.
Go deep.
Don't touch my camera.
You go deep.
After being driven out of post-revolution Iran, the MKO based itself in Camp Ashraf in Iraq, where members were forced to pledge allegiance to its leader Massoud Rajavi and demonstrate that allegiance with cult-like behavior for women that meant divorcing their husbands and marrying him. Many families spent years on the fringes of the camp begging for their children to be released, but to no avail. The camp was later dismantled in the wake of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Until 2012, the MKO was on the U.S. terrorist list. It was also blacklisted by the EU until 2009. Since being removed, the new leader of the cult, Maryam Rajavi, has forged close relationships with Western officials.
What unfolded on the streets of Stockholm today was a shocking reminder that the EU has become a safe haven for the MKO, which attacks journalists like myself with little fear of retribution. The question now is, will there be an investigation? Bianca Rahimi, Stockholm.
Israel has conducted yet another airstrike on Syria, this time south of the capital, Damascus. The Syrian government says It was a missile attack and left a civilian injured. It says the missiles were fired from the occupied Golan Heights. The Syrian army defenses downed most of them. The attack caused material damage as well. Israel frequently attacks Syria but rarely claims responsibility. Damascus says Tel Aviv carries out the attacks to aid terrorist groups fighting the Syrian army. Syria says the Israeli raids violate its sovereignty and territorial integrity and has repeatedly complained to the UN over the attacks. Our correspondent Mohammed Ali is joining us now from the Syrian capital, Damascus, with more details on the recent Israeli airstrike, this time south of the capital, Damascus. Mohammed, what details do you have to share with us?
Yes, residents of Damascus and its countryside woke up at dawn on the sounds of explosions in what turned out to be an Israeli attack on the vicinity of the Syrian capital, Damascus. An official military source confirmed that about 4:20 a.m. local time here in Damascus, Israel carried out an aggression. Several enemy missiles were launched from the direction of the occupied Syrian Golan, targeting several positions in southern Damascus. And according to the official military source here in Syria, Syria's air defenses were able to intercept and shoot down most of the enemy missiles, but however, it seems some of them did hit some positions around the capital, because one civilian was injured and the attack also left some material damages. Also, later on at noon over here, the Ministry of Transport in Syria announced that flights have been suspended in the Damascus International Airport temporarily because some technical equipment are out of service. Now, there are reports saying that the Israeli attack left some damages and at the main runway of the airport. This has not been confirmed officially. However, what is confirmed is that the airport has been perhaps shut down, or flights have been suspended temporarily until it will be the problems, technical problems and damages perhaps will be restored and fixed.
All right, thanks a lot to Mohammed Ali joining us from the Syrian capital, Damascus. Elsewhere, the leader of Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement has urged Israel to stop extracting gas from a maritime field in disputed waters.
The immediate objective should be to prevent the enemy from extracting oil and gas from the Karsh gas field and to stop this activity that will and may have begun. The resistance will not stand by and do nothing in the face of Israel's looting of Lebanon's natural wealth, the looting of Lebanon's treasure, which is the only hope for the salvation of the Lebanese people. It will not stand idly by.
Nasrallah described Israel's operation in the disputed waters as an act of provocation. He also warned a Greek company hired by Israel against proceeding with its activities. Nasrallah said the company is a partner in the Israeli aggression and urged the firm to pull out its ship immediately. The Hezbollah chief said Lebanon has the right to exploit natural resources from the field, stressing that the movement has the capacity to prevent Israel from extracting gas there. At the weekend, an Israeli floating gas production unit arrived in the disputed maritime zone. The move sparked anger of the Lebanese government, which warned Israel against any aggressive actions. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says his forces are holding on in the flashpoint eastern city of Severodonetsk, the focal point of fighting with Russia over the past few weeks. Zelensky says Ukrainian forces are also holding on in several more cities in the eastern Donbas region, liberating their land. Donbas has been the scene of intense fighting taking place in different cities, with Severodonetsk witnessing the fiercest battles. Russia now controls most of the city. The governor of Severodonetsk says the latest Russian attacks have burned down a major sports complex there. Severodonetsk is located in Luhansk province, which Russia says is almost under its full control. Luhansk and Donetsk are two major provinces in Donbas. The war in Ukraine is now in its fourth month. And the European Central Bank has confirmed its intention to hike interest rates at the policy meeting next month. The move is aimed at bringing down soaring prices across the Eurozone. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
There was no sign of pressure on the faces of those who run the European Central Bank when they met on Thursday to agree on bad news for hard-pressed mortgage holders across the 19-nation eurozone. Interest rates will go up by 0.25% next month, most likely 0.5% in September, and that's not where it will end.
Beyond September, based on our current assessment, we anticipate that a gradual but sustained path of further increases in interest rates will be appropriate.
The ECB manages the euro. It will be the bank's first interest rate hike in 11 years. The idea is to bring down inflation. It's now at a record high of 8.1% when the ECB's target is just below 2%. Rising energy, food and accommodation prices are hitting EU citizens hard.
Living in Brussels as well, the cost of living is high already, and then so if it's going up, it's even worse.
Everything is like, so you have to be careful, calculate like exactly what you spend on.
The people got some situation that they don't got enough money to go to the end of the month.
The EU mainly blames Moscow for the financial crisis because of the conflict in Ukraine. The bloc's justice ministers also met on Thursday to figure out a way of seizing the assets of Russian citizens without the need for a conviction in court. Off the back of sanctions against Russia, the EU's economy is on its knees. Critics say Western powers were wrong not to listen to Moscow's security concerns as they built up military capabilities close to Russia's borders and refused to rule out Ukraine joining NATO. ECB bosses are due to meet again to discuss the financial crisis on the 21st of July. Many are asking if the EU's focus stays on arming Ukraine and not conflict resolution, how can things possibly improve between now and then? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Victims of gun crime in the United States are following an alternative path forged by legal actions against cigarette makers, prescription opioid manufacturers, and big oil in an attempt to work around Protection of Law, Commerce in Arms Act, or PLCAA, and a lack of political will to act on gun control to hold the firearms industry accountable for the bloody toll of its products. We have prepared for you an article written by Chris McGreal. The piece is titled, Gun Crime Victims Are Holding the U.S. Firearms Industry Accountable by Taking Them to Court. With each slaughter of innocents, the gun industry offers its sympathy, argues that even more weapons will make America safer, and gives thanks for a two-decade-old law shielding the firearms makers from legal action by the victims. Mike Pfeiffer, the chief executive of one of America's leading handgun manufacturers, Sturm Ruger, once described the 2005 Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act, or PLCAA, as having saved the firearms industry because it stopped in its tracks a wave of lawsuits over the reckless marketing and sales of guns. But now victims of gun crime are following an alternative path forged by legal action against cigarette makers, prescription opioid manufacturers, and big oil in an attempt to work around the Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act, or PLCAA, and a lack of political will to act on gun control to hold the firearms industry accountable for the bloody toll of its products. On Tuesday, 7th of June, Eileen Stewart, who was badly injured when a man fired 33 shots on New York subway in April, wounding 10 people, filed a lawsuit accusing the manufacturer of the semi-automatic pistol used in the attack, a Glock, of breaching public nuisance laws. Eileen Stewart's lawsuit contends that Glock endangered public health and safety in breach of New York state law with an irresponsible marketing campaign to push its guns' high capacity and ease of concealment in an appeal to prospective purchasers with criminal intent. It also accuses gun manufacturer Glock of giving significant discounts to American police departments on weapons purchases to give the gun credibility in the larger and more lucrative civilian market. Mark Shirian, Eileen Stewart's lawyer, said, "Gun manufacturers do not live in a bubble. They are aware that their marketing strategies are empowering purchasers with ill intent and endangering the lives of innocent people. This lawsuit seeks to hold the gun industry accountable. The public nuisance strategy has been used against the tobacco industry for lying about the link between cigarettes and lung cancer, and with mixed success against pharmaceutical companies for creating the US opioid epidemic by recklessly pushing prescription opioids. Public nuisance claims are also at the heart of a series of lawsuits by states and municipalities accusing oil firms of covering up and lying about the part fossil fuels play in driving the climate crisis. Until recently, the gun industry thought that PLCAA provided a shield from similar actions. The National Rifle Association, NRA, persuaded a Republican-controlled Congress to pass the law after the families of people shot by the sniper who terrorized the Washington, D.C. area for 3 weeks in 2002, killing 10 people, won a total of $2.5 million from the gun manufacturer Bushmaster and the store that sold the weapon. But a lawsuit by the families of 20 young children and six staff murdered in the 2012 Sandy Hook Elementary School massacre sought to exploit an exception in PLCAA if a firearm is sold in violation of applicable state or federal laws, in this case, public nuisance, and consumer protection legislation. The Connecticut Supreme Court upheld the argument that the Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act, PLCAA, did not prevent the gunmaker being sued for breach of state laws for irresponsibly militaristic marketing campaigns for its semi-automatic rifles aimed at young men. Remington Arms Company appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, which declined to take the case while it was still in litigation. In February, Remington settled for $73 million. At about the time the Connecticut Supreme Court ruled in favor of the Sandy Hook families, New York introduced the law Eileen Stewart is relying on that expands public nuisance legislation to cover gun crimes. Recently, a federal district judge in New York dismissed an attempt by the gun industry to quash the law on the grounds that it preempted the Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act, or PLCAA. Timothy Litton, a specialist in gun litigation at Georgia State University College of Law and author of Suing the Gun Industry, expects the validity of the New York law and the claim that public nuisance legislation is an exception to the protection given to the gun industry to be appealed all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. He said, "The most important thing that the U.S. Supreme Court needs to decide with regards to firearms litigation is probably the scope of the federal immunity law and whether or not the exception that was relied upon by the Sandy Hook plaintiffs is a viable legal theory. If it's a viable legal theory, then I think you're likely to see an upsurge in litigation." But Litton said legal action against the gun industry face an additional challenge because of the Supreme Court's interpretation of the Second Amendment and the rights it gives to gun owners, a legal area that has also yet to be more widely tested. He said, "There are limits on the ability to sue a newspaper for libel because of the First Amendment. It may be the case that the Second Amendment has similar restrictions on the ability of individuals to hold the firearms manufacturers liable. But we don't know what those restrictions might be because we have very little indication from the Supreme Court about what the Second Amendment actually protects, other than a basic right for an individual to own a firearm that they can use for ordinary purposes." Still, as litigation against the tobacco, opioid and oil industry demonstrates, the point of lawsuits is not only to win in court. After each massacre, the gun industry usually seeks to blame the individual shooter and a failure of systems such as mental health services. Litton said lawsuits put the focus back on the actions of the firearms makers and forces public discussion of how they sell their weapons.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wa salam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى ابن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners, and I'm your host, Mahdi. We're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam led a life which was in balance and harmony with that of the Prophet Muhammad, his great-great-grandfather. His life and the life of Imam al-Kadhim was in the line and the direction of the Prophet Muhammad. And of course, the life of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam was a strict adherence and obedience of Islam in so many different ways, whether it was his ethics, his morals, his behaviors, his actions, his statements. We find that Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the copy of the Holy Prophet Muhammad of Islam, the messenger of Allah. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam led an upright, righteous, and noble life. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام وقد سئل عن عشرة أقمصة هل ذلك من الصرف؟ لا، ولكن ذلك أبقى لثيابه، ولكن الصرف أن تلبس ثوب صونك في المكان القدر.
Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam, when asked about whether owning 10 shirts was considered a waste, replied, no. And in fact, that is more conducive to longer wear of your clothes. Waste is when you wear your formal finery to unclean places, as casual wear.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It is a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, when we talk about the beautiful conversations and the dialogues of the seventh divinely appointed Imam, Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim alayhi salam, we find that His Eminence taught His companions these beautiful lifestyle guidelines. These guidelines which can ultimately lead to the perfection and the completion of a human being. And really, they are these different guidelines and these different pointers that Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam gave to his companion in this dialogue, that these guidelines are something that even in the present day are applicable to our lives, and they can really improve and perfect our lives. And so here, when Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam was speaking with his companion, he brought up this really interesting thing. And it's so interesting that I found it appropriate to bring it up on the program. Imam al-Kadhim says that the wonder of wonders, meaning the amazing thing of amazing things, the wonder of wonders is those who are on a diet and drink, lest they should be infected by a malady. So just before I continue on to the second aspect, so Imam al-Kadhim is saying, it's really amazing that there are certain people who go on a diet and, you know, they don't drink certain things or they don't eat certain things, or there's a new, you know, fad diet out there, you know, which will help us to, you know, reduce our weight, or in this case, as Imam al-Kadhim says, in order to reduce us being infected by some sort of disease or malady. So he says, the wonder of wonders is those who are on a diet, lest they should be infected by a malady. But they do not guard against sins out of fear of the fire when it shall burn their bodies. So dear brothers and sisters, we really are careful in what we eat. We count our calories.
We make sure we don't drink sugary drinks. We make sure to not eat a lot of candy. Or on the other hand, we even go to the extent of not eating red meat or not eating carbohydrates or not eating some certain thing in order to protect ourselves from becoming sick. But we don't think about those things which will destroy our soul, those things which will infect our soul, those things which will disease our soul, and those things are sins. We do not protect ourselves from sins, despite the fact that these sins will end up resulting in a fire which will burn our bodies and our souls in the hereafter. So just as we protect ourselves from physical disease, we must and must protect ourselves from spiritual diseases as well. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Kadhim, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Sodagar.
The aspect of, or I should say, one of the aspects that made the imamah of Imam al-Kadhim, salamullah alayhi, very critical is the conditions that ended up being the conditions of the ummah and the conditions of the movements of the Ahlul Bayt during that period. That period was an important period. The struggle that Imam al-Kadhim, salamullah alayhi, deals with, although it includes continuing that and giving more clarity to more people regarding the Ahlul Bayt not being the Abbasids and the Abbasids not being the Ahlul Bayt of the Prophet, although that was part of it. But the aspect that we are addressing right now is something that is a little different, and that is to keep the movement of the Ahlul Bayt alive. Let's not forget, we discussed extensively what a movement is about. The movement, especially the political movement, which the movement of the Ahlul Bayt was a political movement. Within it, it had elements of education, elements of ahkam, fiqh, tafsir, kalam, and so on and so forth. But at the center of it was a political objective of removing the unjust and unauthorized rule of those who were ruling, and to establish the rule of those that God has given the responsibility to rule. This was a very political movement, and it still is a political movement.
Listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The end of the fake regime of Israel is writ large on the wall, says Ayman Ahmad, journalist, in an article published under the heading Zionist Israel's Impending Doom. Here's the details. Like all oppressors, the Zionist entity displays two contradictory traits: extreme cruelty towards the Palestinians under occupation and fear of resistance. This has led some Israeli regime officials to express deep concern about its survival. Take Ehud Barak. He's no pacifist or alarmist since he had served as both the regime's army chief and as prime minister. He has said that the Zionist entity may not live to see its 80th birthday. The 80th year curse, as it is called, is part of Jewish history. No Jewish regime has lasted longer than 80 years. There is no reason to believe its present iteration would live past this time frame. There are good reasons for this grim prognosis. There are both internal and external reasons for this. The vast majority of Israeli citizens do not believe it would last long. This explains their obsession with getting a second passport, mostly of some European country. Clearly, they do not believe an Israeli passport provides enough security. When Tel Aviv airport was opened for international flights soon after the Israeli regime's onslaught on Gaza ended in May 2021, some 50,000 Israeli citizens fled occupied Palestine. In addition to their historical fear, and it may well come to pass, there are also more pressing immediate concerns. One is the Palestinians' refusal to be cowed down despite the Zionist extreme brutality and its brazen support by Western regimes. The latest example of this was witnessed in the execution-style killing of Al Jazeera journalist Shirin Abu Aghla on May 11th. She was shot and killed by an Israeli regime sniper outside Jenin refugee camp, despite wearing a jacket clearly marked in bold letters as press. Western regimes, led by the US and joined by others like Canada, Britain, and a host of Europeans, merely called for an investigation into the death of Abu Aghla. They could not even bring themselves to admit that she was murdered. By saying she died, it gave the impression as if this was something natural. The New York Times put a similar misleading headline on May 12th about her execution-style killing. It said, Shirin Abu Aghla, trailblazing Palestinian journalist, dies at 51. Compare this to its headline of March 13th regarding Brent Reno. Brent Reno, an American journalist, is killed in Ukraine. Shirin Abu Aghla was also an American citizen, but such information was largely missing from media or even official U.S. reports. Why the contrasting descriptions? Further, the Times merely re-argued Israeli propaganda that there was firing between Palestinian gunmen and Israeli regime forces. This has since been debunked by eyewitnesses as well as CNN. Renault died when the car was traveling came under fire at a checkpoint in Ukraine. Abu Aghila was specifically targeted by an Israeli regime sniper. He knew precisely that he was targeting. The bullet was fired using a U.S.-supplied M16 rifle with a telescopic sight that fired at the small opening between Abu Aghila's steel helmet and her bulletproof collar. It was a targeted killing. Under Nitzan pressure, the NYT corrected its headline, but its pro-Israel bias was clearly evident. Let us, however, return to the issue of fears about the Zionist regime's survivability. Several factors can be cited. While indulging in extreme cruelty against the Palestinians, targeted killings, home demolitions, night raids on Palestinian homes to arrest people, and imprisoning thousands of Palestinians, including women and children, it has successfully peddled a narrative of victimhood. The Western corporate media simply parrots this nonsensical lie. Western regimes led by the U.S., but now joined by Britain, France, Germany and Canada, among others, have also launched vicious campaigns criminalizing calls for boycott, divestment and sanctions BDS movement. In the Queen's speech in Parliament last month, the Boris Johnson regime declared it would ban local councils and other public bodies from participating in boycott and divestment campaigns. France has banned marches that criticize the Zionist regime's crimes and invasions. Similar restrictive policies have been implemented in Germany. Both in the US and Canada, similar campaigns have been launched to stifle criticism of the Zionist regime's crimes. For instance, 27 states in the U.S. have forbidden campaigns and educational institutions from joining the BDS campaign. In Canada, both the federal government and the Ontario provincial government have signed onto the International Remembrance Alliance definition that equates criticism of the Israeli regime with anti-Semitism. It has faced pushback from academic institutions as well as from many fair-minded Jewish groups. Why are these regimes so desperate to ram down the throats of their citizens' policies that clearly violate the fundamental rights of the people? They are supporting an oppressive colonial settler entity in the West Asia region. Therein lies the crux of the matter. Despite being the most ruthless military machine in the West Asia region and beyond, the Western regimes see in occupied Palestine their own past. Canada and the U.S. are colonial settler entities. The European settlers perpetrated genocides against indigenous peoples in North America. Most of them came from Britain, France, Spain, and Portugal. The Western regimes do not see anything wrong with the fake regime of Israel indulging in similar genocide of the Palestinian people. In fact, they applaud such despicable conduct because it validates their own past behavior. The challenge that Zionist Israel faces today is that it is virtually impossible for it to wipe out the Palestinians as was done by the European settlers many centuries earlier. The socio-political and information environments are very different today. The alternative media continues to expose the ugly face of Zionism and its barbaric practices against the Palestinian people. Amnesty International has exposed the apartheid nature of Israel, as has the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights in its annual report into the human rights violations in Palestine and other occupied Palestinian territories. The UN report follows the publication of similar findings of Israeli apartheid by Human Rights Watch, Al-Haq, Al-Mizan Center for Human Rights, and Israeli human rights organizations B'Tselem, Yesh Din, and many other international and regional human rights organizations. Not surprisingly, the Zionist regime clamped down on Palestinian human rights organizations for documenting its violations of human rights of the Palestinians and advocating for accountability by all duty bearers. In October 2021, the fake regime of Israel outlawed 6 Palestinian human rights organizations, accusing them of aiding and abetting terrorism. Concurrent with these, the resistance front is becoming increasingly sophisticated. Comprising Islamic Iran, Hezbollah in Lebanon, the Palestinian Islamic groups Hamas and Islamic Jihad, Syria, and Ansarullah in Yemen, and resistance groups in Iraq have all become formidable opponents of the fake regime of Israel and the Zionist entity. It is, however, the solidarity of movements in Western countries and around the world, and the growth of BDS movements on campuses that frightens the Zionist regime so much. Similarly, its own population has no confidence in its long-term survival. The end of Israel is writ large on the wall.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, Hadith of the Day, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on Hadith of the Day, we're going to be looking at a very noble tradition and hadith, which has been narrated from Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam. This hadith is about affliction. And in this tradition, the Imam alludes to the reward for enduring an affliction. Ajrul masa'ib, meaning if somebody's, God forbid, is afflicted with a affliction, a problem, a calamity, God forbid, and he patiently endures what he is going through, and then God Almighty will reward him and give him a reward for what he is doing, his patience. In this tradition, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says, he said the following to a man who was experiencing intense grief at the loss of his son. Right? May God forbid anybody go through this problem. But this person, his son passed away, and he was very sad at this, and he was unable to contain himself. The Imam said, "You are grieving at the minor affliction and are heedless of the major affliction." Meaning, you are grieving at something very small, a very small problem. But there's another big problem that you are unaware of. If you were aware of it, you would grieve about this major affliction. "If only you had prepared yourself for the place that your son has passed away to, your grief would not be so intense." Meaning, the Imam is alluding to the hereafter, you know, and death and everything that will transpire at that time. The Imam says that because you haven't prepared yourself for that day, you are grieving at this small problem. If you